for Gallup, I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we check in on the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians through the lens of U.S. public opinion and also by examining the latest events taking place across Jerusalem and Gaza. First, let's check in with Gallup's Director for U.S. Research, Lydia Saad, on the state of American public opinion on the conflict itself. Lydia, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Muhammad.
Let me start by asking, just generally, over the past few years, what key metrics has Gallup used to gauge American sentiment on the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians?
So we have about five core measures that we track regularly, if not annually. The annual measures are just basic favorable ratings that we ask those of many countries annually as part of our World Affairs survey each February. So we ask Americans if they have a favorable or unfavorable opinion of about 20 different countries, and we always include Israel and the Palestinian Authority on that. Then we have another question that goes back to 1988, asking Americans whether their sympathies in the quote-unquote Middle East situation are more with the Israelis or the Palestinians. And so that's waxed and waned over the decades. We can talk about that. And then separately, we've asked occasionally since 1994 whether Americans support the establishment of an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And then more occasionally, we've asked Americans which side they think the United States should put more pressure on to resolve the conflict, and then also whether they view the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a critical threat to U.S. vital interests. And I hope we get a chance to talk about that because I think that's interesting in the context of other potential threats Americans perceive.
Well, let's start there. A lot of interest in sort of the U.S. position, of course, is always when the conflict flares up. Do Americans see the conflict as something critical to U.S. vital interests, and has that changed over time?
Yeah, so the question is not really, in sort of absolute terms, yes, when we give them a choice of, is it a critical threat, important, but not critical, or not important? A majority say, well, it's at least important, but this year we found just about a third saying it's a critical threat. So most do not see it as a critical threat. And that compares with, you know, to pick a very timely issue, 82% of Americans consider cyber terrorism a critical threat. 72% consider regular old international terrorism as a critical threat. 63% consider the economic power of China as a critical threat. 58% global warming. So, you know, in the context of other challenges that the U.S. faces around the world, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict does not, you know, hold up as something Americans see as particularly threatening to the U.S. vital interests. And it never has. It's never been a top-ranking issue on that sort of question.
Let me ask you, in terms of just overall sentiments, what changes have we seen over time, if any?
Well, it's probably easier to start off by saying what hasn't changed. So broadly, Americans have always expressed a higher favorable view of Israel than the Palestinians. And we've tracked both annually since 2000. And they've also been, on balance, more likely to say they sympathize with the Israelis and the Palestinians. So those basic parameters haven't changed. At the same time, more have always supported than opposed Palestinian statehood, including majorities saying that, just slim majorities, but still a majority saying that in recent years. So there's a duality there. There's sort of this more comfort and sympathy and favorability toward Israel, but recognition of Palestinian aspirations for their own country. Now, the degrees of those, you know, have changed at the margins, but the big picture is pretty steady on those things.
Let me ask you, Lydia, how party ID matches up with some of these sentiments. Are there any particular trends we see across or within party line?
Yes, and that is, you know, they're really eye-popping. So the biggest changes we have seen over time are by party, and to some extent, because they are countervailing, the overall trends are sort of look more steady, but beneath the surface, we have these big shifts by party. So we've seen over the past two decades, Republicans becoming increasingly monolithic in their support of Israel, their preference for Israel or sympathy for Israel over the Palestinians in the conflict, while Democrats' sympathies for Israel, they've held up, but we've seen increasing also sympathy for the Palestinians and sort of less taking a middle ground or not taking sides. And so the effect of that has been we have now like 80% of Republicans saying they are more sympathetic toward Israel than the Palestinians, whereas back in 1998, it was half that level at like 43%. Meanwhile, Democrats' sympathies have gone from like 37% sympathize more with the Israelis back in 1998. Today, that's actually 43%, but the percentage sympathizing with the Palestinians has grown from 15% to 38%. So Democrats now are very closely split, really, in their views on the conflict, whereas Republicans are very clearly more on the Israeli side.
Lydia, any other demographic differences or things that have surprised you in these trends? I know these are questions you've been studying for quite some time. Anything that's surprising?
It's hard to surprise a pollster, Mohammed. we've seen it all. You know, everything kind of knits together. If things surprise you, there's often something wrong in the data. That's what we look for as our smell test on data. But there's so many interesting things. That's more the perspective I have. You know, one of the very interesting things about public opinion on the Middle East is there's a religious factor to it. So white evangelical Christians come to this issue with deeply held religious beliefs about the Holy Land, and they are more sympathetic to Israel as a result. And non-religious people are, you know, much less supportive of Israel. That gap has also kind of expanded over time, parallel with the Republican-Democratic gaps. And again, they're tied in together, so it's not surprising. But it's, you know, it's more than a political issue, especially in this country. And then I think one thing that's very important to note is the age differences on this. Older Americans who have been around, if not since the establishment of Israel, certainly through a lot of turmoil in the Arab-Israeli conflict, are more sympathetic to the Israelis. In our most recent survey, 66% of people 55 and older said they sympathize more with the Israelis, 21% with the Palestinians. You get down to 18 to 34-year-olds, and it's a much narrower split, 47 Israelis, 34% Palestinians. So, you know, some age trends are life cycle, you know, religiosity. We tend to see younger people become more religious as they get older, or other things are transformational. And so this is something to watch with young people. Are they going to hold these views as they age and there will be going forward? So that's something I think that's notable.
That's Lydia Saad. Always a pleasure, Lydia, to speak with you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Next, let's check in with someone who can place the latest tragic events into the larger context of this historic conflict. Khaled Al-Gindi is director of the Program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian Affairs at the Middle East Institute. He's also author of the new book, Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Khaled, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by just having you update us on what has been happening in Jerusalem in the past few days and what triggered these latest clashes that we see now unfolding across screens throughout the world.
The latest clashes began in East Jerusalem. I mean, of course, everything's been overtaken now with what's going on in Gaza. For the past several weeks, there have been demonstrations going on in a particular neighborhood of East Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, which is adjacent to the Old City. It's just north of Damascus Gate in the Old City, and it's a very important area for Palestinians. It's a commercial area, but also a residential area, and it's also been the target of strategic settlement planning by both radical settler groups and Israeli government authorities. And those groups, you know, both Israeli government and settler groups have been sort of house by house, you know, making these, you know, taking over properties and buildings in various parts of Sheikh Jarrah, and as well as other parts of occupied East Jerusalem. And in the process, many Palestinians are actually being evicted. And so there are about 18 or so families in Sheikh Jarrah who are faced with imminent expulsion in order to hand their homes over to Israeli settlers. And these are families that have lived there in some cases even before Israel was created. And So there's a lot of kind of legalistic and pseudo legalistic machinations going on to try to engineer and give some cover to these takeovers, but it's a pretty naked and transparent, you know, removing Palestinians and replacing them with Jewish settlers in a very strategic part of Jerusalem. And so there have been these protests of these families that have mobilized Palestinians in Jerusalem, as well as garnered a lot of solidarity in the international community, including members of Congress who started to weigh in on this in the past couple of days before things blew up in Gaza. And those protests were met with violence by Israeli authorities, pretty harsh crackdown, beatings, you know, sound grenades, tear gas, very, very harsh measures, you know, in full riot gear against these protesters. And they actually spread. They spread to other parts of the city, including at Al-Aqsa Mosque, which, you know, as you know, is Islam's third holiest shrine or site. And also, it's especially important in the last few days of Ramadan when lots of people go there. So there were demonstrations at Al-Aqsa. There were Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque for several nights in a row. And you know, videos coming out of beatings and tear gassings and people holed up inside the mosque. It was only a matter of time. I mean, it you know, a lot of us were commenting at the time that the Israeli response was so harsh that it seemed almost designed to escalate. And that's exactly what happened. Hamas jumped in. They saw an opportunity to declare themselves the defenders of Al-Aqsa and launched a barrage of rockets, which, of course, Israel very predictably responded with airstrikes and artillery attacks in Gaza. And here we are.
Yeah. That's Al-Khaled. That was a really excellent way to take us like case by case in terms of how did we get to where we are. So, and as you said, here we are, another escalating conflict between primarily really organizations in Gaza, like Hamas and the Israeli military. Let's take a step back and think about U.S. foreign policy. When we ask Americans about kind of how focused they are on this issue, it really doesn't rank very high in terms of public opinion. But Americans are overwhelmingly in support of the state of Israel, Israeli interests. Although that's as you alluded to, that's changing a little bit with younger Americans. What do you, in your view, what would an effective U.S. foreign policy coming out of the Biden team be right now? It's been interesting to see them get a little bit of criticism for trying to sort of stay a little bit further away from the heat of the fire and not really get directly involved.
Yeah, so let me take that second part first. So yeah, they are getting some heat for what a lot of people are describing a hands-off approach. And basically people calling them out and saying, you know, look, there is no such thing as a hands-off U.S. approach when it comes to anything having to do with Israel, because Israel, there's a special relationship. We are heavily invested in Israel's military, of all things, $3.8 billion worth each year. And so we are very hands-on and very much engaged. The Biden administration just the other day, you know, they're running interference at the Security Council on behalf of Israel, making sure there isn't any statement coming out of the Security Council. And at the same time, they're talking about de-escalation. And so that's kind of hard to square. So, you know, people aren't buying this line that they're disengaged by not doing anything on the diplomatic front, or in this case, actively scuttling diplomacy at the Security Council, they are actively kind of supporting, you know, they're sort of green lighting what's happening. And, you know, unless they're directly and actively trying to restrain Israel, then they are basically active participants in what Israel is doing. And let's not forget, you know, there's an enormous asymmetry here in every way, in power, in economy, in political capital, in diplomatic influence, technologically, in every possible way, but especially on the military side. And so, you know, Hamas rockets can do damage, but mostly they terrorize. You know, there is, you know, unfortunately, there is loss of life on the Israeli side, and there is some destruction. But the disproportionality is so overwhelming. When you, if you look at the footage of what's happening in Gaza, and there aren't too many places showing it, but it, you know, Al Jazeera and others are, and it's quite horrific in terms of the scale of these attacks, and it's, you know, overwhelmingly it's the civilians and especially children who suffer. I mean, we now have a generation of Palestinians in Gaza who've never known anything but siege, destruction, war, and who are severely traumatized. And so to imagine that that could in any way enhance Israel's security is really a bizarre notion. And it should just be, it should be common sense that what you're doing is actually creating more instability.
All of this comes at a time of a political vacuum, so to speak, both in the Israeli government context, but also with the Palestinian Authority. We just saw an election. Benjamin Netanyahu is currently, after breaking the record, I think, of being the longest standing prime minister of Israel, has just essentially lost an election. There, we were right in the middle of government formation negotiations to emerge under a new leader. And you can tell us a little bit about that. But on the Palestinian side, there's also, you know, historic infighting and a lack of representation. How does the political vacuum on both sides feed into or not the escalation that we're seeing now?
Yeah, it's interesting because despite the huge asymmetry, and Israelis have, you know, one of the other key differences that Israelis have formal institutional politics, whereas the Palestinians don't. Their political institutions are stagnant and paralyzed. And you know, as you mentioned, they even recently called off the elections that they were supposed to have. But on the, you know, so there are some interesting parallels between the two sides' politics and between the two leaders, Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas. But for at the moment, I mean, Netanyahu is still prime minister. I wouldn't count him out entirely. I think the Bennett-Lapid bloc has their work cut out for them. It's going to be very hard to cobble together a coalition, especially with, you know, it's still a very solidly right-wing bloc. I mean, the Israeli Knesset is overwhelmingly right-wing. They're just polarized between the anti-Netanyahu right wing and the pro-Netanyahu right wing. And so the opposition to Netanyahu still includes a very large right wing component. They're going to sit in the same government with Labor and Meretz and, you know, whatever's left of the left in Israel, never mind the Arab parties that have to lend their support to this coalition. So that's a very precarious situation there. And I wouldn't rule out the possibility of a fifth election sometime later this year. But you're right that there is a kind of leadership and decision-making vacuum. But very often when we have these kinds of flare-ups, especially in things related to Gaza, the military just sort of kicks in. You know, there's a kind of muscle memory that kicks in and they're, you know, they've got a mind of their own and they operate, they've got contingency plans and they're just operating, you know, the security military establishment, can do its own thing. So that's what's happening. And there's pretty strong consensus. You know, Gaza is the one thing that all Israelis political groups can agree on, and that is just hammer Gaza as much as you can. There's degrees of how harsh you should be. What's worrying is that because you now have these very hard right extremists in the Knesset, people who were, you know, they're Kahanists, you know, they're groups that are in the United States designated officially as terrorist organizations, and that were banned in Israel, but now are, you know, being welcomed into the Knesset. These groups are, upping the rhetoric. They're talking in terms of erasing Gaza. And so it's a really, really scary moment if you have a political vacuum and a discourse that is being driven by these extremists. And we've seen Netanyahu time and again will acquiesce and very often court these hard right extremists because they work for his agenda, because they help him stay in power. So that, you know, his political opportunism, the political vacuum, the military sort of operating by remote control, all of these things, and extremists in the mix, all of these things are very worrying for how things play out.
Let me just close by asking you, Khaled, in terms of the other regional actors in the neighborhood, anything that you've noticed that's different to their reactions in this latest escalation, and any solutions that can be found there?
Well, obviously, we're in a post-Abraham Accords environment, just even in the midst of these demonstrations in Jerusalem and the violence in Jerusalem, you had the ambassador of the UAE taking pictures with the U.S. chargé, celebrating normalization, and against the backdrop of this violence. And so there's a bit of a disconnect there. I think now that things have really escalated, and especially since the attacks on Al-Aqsa, we've seen more, at least rhetorical condemnation coming out of Arab states, including some of the normalizing countries like the UAE, who are condemning the Sheikh Jarrah expulsions and condemning, excessive use of force and things like that. I don't think we're going to see more than rhetoric really from the Arab states. But there are a couple states that play a key role, namely Egypt, directly as mediators, as people who are talking to all parties. And there aren't many of those because the United States, of course, can't talk to Hamas. The Israelis don't talk to Hamas directly. And the Egyptians do talk to Hamas, and they talk to the Israelis, both military and political leadership. They're talking, of course, to the Palestinian Authority, who are at the moment pretty irrelevant and mostly watching from the sidelines. So Egypt has a very important role to play in terms of brokering a ceasefire, maybe even more important than the role of the United States, where the U.S. comes in, of course, is in reigning in Israel. That's the one place, that's the only place, really, that it has any influence. Whether it can use it or is willing to use it is a different question. But I think what's different this time is the region in 2014 was sort of indifferent to a Gaza war. And it's one of the things that allowed it to go on for as long as it did, especially the Egyptians. The Egyptians were very hands-off in that war. This time they're much more engaged because they have direct interests at stake on the ground, and the Egyptians play a key role there.
That's Khaled El-Gindi, Director of the Program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian Affairs at the Middle East Institute. Khaled, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's good to see you.
And finally, to explore how these latest clashes are unfolding across Israeli communities, as well as Washington's likely next moves on the crisis, we speak to Dr. Natan Sachs, director of the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. Natan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me start where I started with Khaled. From your perspective, how did this escalate so quickly?
What we saw is first the events in Jerusalem, of course, precipitating all of this. And there we saw a very different dynamic, a confluence of both national issues, national narratives around the impending evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, and then also religious narratives, of course, with the violence on Haram Sharif or Temple Mount and the Israeli police entering into the mosque. So we saw from the Israeli side there in particular both a lack of attention, but also astounding bad judgment by the police chief and also by the minister in charge of him. This led partly by omission to really the escalation that we saw, especially on Temple Mount and then towards Jerusalem Day and Laylat al-Qadr, which almost coincided. Then we saw Hamas finding an opportunity and really changing this whole conflict into what it knows best, which is the indiscriminate firing of now well over a thousand rockets towards Israeli civilians. But it's not exactly a repeat of the past. We see here much better capabilities by Hamas. The range of the rockets is significantly longer than it was, so much so that most of the Israeli population is right now not just in range, but being targeted actively and running to shelters. So most of the Israeli population was running to shelters 2 nights ago and has since, in some cases, continued. And we saw also some of the rockets getting through, getting past the Iron Dome defenses, which are still very effective, but with very large number of rockets, especially those concentrated and relatively well aimed compared to the past, we saw some coming through and casualties and hits in cities, a child in Sderot right by Gaza and others, on top of what we've seen in the past too, which of course is many civilian casualties inside Gaza, including children on the very first day.
And it really is, of course, always tragic to see these deaths on either side, on any side. And some of these attacks, particularly for the Israeli communities, really haven't seen this level of danger, fear, really since 2014, maybe even since 2008. So it really is a unique kind of alarming moment.
I'd add more, so, you know, from the Israeli perspective, and this affects their calculation, of course, if you think of the way the centers of population, especially Greater Tel Aviv, the largest sort of populated area, this is more or less unprecedented. So it's not 2014, 2008, because Hamas did not have the same capabilities then. It was targeting the south in Israel, where humans are exactly the same, but it is not the bulk of the Israeli population. The Israeli population, you know, the last time Tel Aviv was targeted by missiles was in the first Gulf War with Iraqi Scuds, but they in total were, you know, I think it was 30 some Scuds. It was very scary and they were very large rockets, but it was nowhere near this. So to a certain degree, this is unprecedented and that changes the Israeli psyche quite a bit. And then, but add to that, of course, the main component that you mentioned already, which is that this has come into the Israeli streets. Now we've seen in several mixed cities and towns with sizable Jewish and Arab populations, we've seen gang violence, communal violence, images that you see in the Middle East way too often, but you have not seen in Israel in many, many decades, perhaps since 48, of actual communal violence and targeting of Jews and Arabs as Jews or Arabs at the individual level. This is extremely troubling. It shouldn't be overblown in a sense that it's not all of Israel is simply rioting, but it should not be underestimated too. The scenes in some of the cities, in particular Lod or Lida in the center of this country, are really terrible. And there is truly a moment of reckoning sort of in Israel. This is related, of course, closely to the conflict with Gaza and especially to Jerusalem before that, but is separate from it to a degree and will require very different means and very different time frame to deal with.
And that's a really important dynamic, I think, for what we started off the episode really talking about how much America or the American public really focuses on the conflict. And obviously, as you probably know, Natan, not too much focus until things are at this state. But what's happening on the communal level in a lot of these cities now between Israeli citizens who are Jewish or Palestinian of Christian or Muslim faith. It is really unique to a lot of us who've been watching the conflict, you know, ebb and flow for quite some time. Tell us a little bit more about what we've seen happen, and also tell us about what the political discourse has been like from leadership within Israeli political parties to try to calm things down.
So the relations between the Jewish majority, and it's about 75 or 80% of the country, and the Palestinian citizen minority, which is about 21%, the relations there have been fraught, of course, for many decades, since well before 1948. But they have had interesting dynamics recently. In some ways, worse. We've seen an outing of some of the extremist rhetoric to high levels of politics, and Netanyahu was certainly part of that until very recently. But we've also seen dynamics where the Arab population inside Israel, in terms of socioeconomic measures, in terms of birth rates and in education levels, has actually come closer to the Jewish majority. I don't want to paint a rosy picture. There are enormous structural problems and they're very severe. But in some important measures, and birth rates are important because they are often an indicator, for example, of women's education and other choices, they have become much closer to the Jewish population. And so we've seen also very positive trends. Very recently, as you know, perhaps Israel's had 4 national elections in just the last 2 years. So it's in a deep political crisis. The last of these rounds of elections, we've seen Prime Minister Netanyahu make a pretty astounding about face and almost have an alliance or an implicit alliance with one of the parties representing mostly Arab citizens, and in fact, Muslim citizens. It's an Islamic party. And in that, he has done a few things. I mean, it was a smart political move in trying to keep himself in power, but also it legitimized the idea that other parties, including from the right, like Netanyahu's party, might be dealing with the minority. And that also has some very positive ramifications from my perspective. Now, when we see this violence, this very state of nature base kind of violence, this calls all this into question. It also means that perhaps some of these voices on the political level have a bit more voice than they did even just a year ago. And we have seen some of them call for calm. There have been some important calls that way. But it does call very much into question the partial positive moves that we've also seen in majority-minority relations. Another political dynamic that we've seen, a very troubling one recently, is the entrance of not just the far right, but the truly racist right into the far right party in Israel, very much orchestrated by Netanyahu, to his shame, I have to say. And especially the particular individual who entered the Knesset now from what used to be Kahana's party, an overtly racist party, he actually himself personally had a hand in inciting a lot of the violence in Jerusalem. He set up his parliamentary office temporarily in Sheikh Jarrah just to make a point. And we're seeing now some of the gang violence are tied, perhaps not to him personally, that would be a legal matter, but to organizations very much affiliated in common perception with his party and with others. And so we're seeing dynamics going in all direction, honestly, in a moment of a lot of questioning in Israel of where this might lead and of how just basic amity, basic ability to coexist in a very complex society can be restored. I'd like to add on this one more important point, which is, you know, when we look abroad, we look at another country. So, you know, I see images from Myanmar now. You're obviously going to see the worst scenes because that's what's going to make the news. What's remarkable often is that almost in every society, the daily coexistence, sometimes awkward, unpleasant, uncomfortable, is far more common than violence, right? So if you think of even Israeli society, and again, I'm not belittling any of the deep structural problems, Muslims, Christians, Jews, they interact every day, all the time. Muslim doctors are treating Jewish patients and vice versa, and no one even knows who the nurse is. So of course they appreciate the nurse. I mean, they don't know their background of nurse. So that means that in a society that is so complex and so multifaceted, this kind of violence that brings people naturally into their tribe and makes them afraid of the other, natural fear, is very dangerous. Getting this genie out of the bottle is to my mind, much worse than even thousands of rockets flying over the head. And I think many Israelis from all walks of life are very concerned about this. Not that they're not concerned about the fact that they have to drag their children to the bomb shelter at 3 a.m., that too. But at new scenes of really a fraying of society at the seams, that's deeply troubling.
It's such an important message, I think, particularly to a mostly American audience, frankly, who, again, only really focuses on this issue when things really unfortunately come to these kind of tragic blows back and forth. But it's such an important part of this dynamic is this daily resilience of really human nature and the human story. On the individual level. Let me ask you, I'm sitting here just outside of Washington. Is it even fair for me to ask you what a competent U.S. policy looks like in this moment from your perspective? What should the folks, I know, of course, your former colleague from Brookings, Hedi Amr, is probably already arrived and heavily involved in conveying the President of the United States position on the matter. But more than sort of calming things down, what do the next couple steps look like for the U.S. if you were to be advising them?
It's a very difficult situation, and there are a few complicating factors. The first is that, you know, the United States can impose some things in some circumstances, but usually in these kinds of conflicts, and this is already round four of major violence between these two sides, you need to get the two sides to more or less want it. And if they don't exactly want it, then you twist their arm. But the two belligerent sides have to feel that they have a moment when they can cease fire, depending, of course, on their interests. So in the past, for Hamas, often the violence was an attempt to get concessions from Israel about the conditions in the Gaza Strip, the very terrible conditions in the Gaza Strip. And for Israel, it was usually about the prospect of future armament of Hamas and how much it could threaten its citizens, and in particular about rockets on civilians in southern Israel and now in central Israel, and in fact, all the way to the north of the Galilee. This time it's a bit different. Hamas entered this not with a list of grievances about the Gaza Strip. The situation is still terrible in the Gaza Strip, but actually there has been some advancement, an advancement even through cooperation between Israel and Hamas and with others as well, the Egyptians always and the Qataris from the other side, although they don't like each other so much. For example, energy and electricity in the Gaza Strip has improved dramatically with the prospect of continuing to improve with some Qatari funding and with very strong Israeli cooperation. Not that there's any love lost between the sides, but there has been an attempt to improve routine things. Hamas entered into this and decided to shoot these rockets in an attempt to wrest the Jerusalem issue and become the defender of Jerusalem, with religious undertones, of course, but also national ones. And so the question for Hamas is now very different than in the past. To a degree, its success in striking Israeli cities and civilians in the first night allowed it very quickly to say, okay, now we're willing to cease fire. For the Israelis, we're partially surprised by the capabilities of Hamas. There's an attempt to deal with some of these capabilities, which means trying to find them through intelligence very fast, and then trying to deal them via through the air and perhaps with some ground incursions, although I don't expect major ground incursions. And so the Americans will have to try and square a circle between all these very different interests and do the two sides. Is there a moment where America can push the sides and twist some arms and get them to cease fire? I think it may not be far. The internal pressures and the communal violence inside Israel that I mentioned before add some urgency for the Israeli government to calm things down. But it is not simple because the military and civilians, honestly, who see the capabilities that Hamas has managed to amass since the last time in 2014, will demand some answers to what can the military do contra this. And I'll add a second point. The second complication is that the United States doesn't deal directly with Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization in American designation as well as Israeli. That means that American officials cannot officially at least deal with Hamas. And so you have to get a lot of others. And of course, America has almost no leverage over Hamas. So it has to get others to help. The Egyptians, despite the tension between the Egyptians and the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hamas is an offshoot of it, nonetheless have close security ties no affinity, but they have close security coordination in an attempt to calm things down. Egypt, of course, borders the Gaza Strip, just as Israel does. It's part of the blockade. And the Qataris I mentioned already, who are much more sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood and toward Hamas in general, have much more say and leverage, and also some funding that gives them the leverage. There are other countries that have leverage over Hamas, Iran in particular, but the United States doesn't deal very seriously with Iran on these issues, at least. So there's a lot of international coordination that has to take place, bringing in these different parties, and it's not simple. The Egyptians and Qataris do not speak to one another very fondly. The Israelis and the Egyptians do now actually coordinate very closely. The Israelis and the Qataris have a strained but working relations. I mentioned already the gas and electricity and other things that happened with coordination between them. That can be done. So it's a very difficult task. My former colleague is certainly there and representing the president. It's not only up to him or diplomatic skills of an individual. It is a very difficult structural situation. The United States plays a very important role, but I have to say, going in, you know, the United States, if you think of the priorities of President Biden, I can name about five extremely important domestic priorities that come before any foreign policy. I don't think I need to tell Gallup that. And then on top of that, in foreign policy, Russia, of course, China first, Russia, Asia, you know, Asia writ large. Then in the Middle East, you have Iran. What the Biden administration really wanted from the Israelis and Palestinians was to be quiet for about 4 years. And they're not quiet. That's not their tendency. But the Biden administration is not set up correctly also to deal with this. There's no permanent ambassador in Israel. There's very little infrastructure besides my former colleague that you mentioned.
On that really important and critical note, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Natan Sachs, Director of the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mo. Really my pleasure.
That's our show. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe and stay up to date with our latest conversations, just search for the Gallup Podcast wherever you podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us on Twitter at Gallup News. If you have suggestions for the show, email podcast@gallup.com. The Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.